recording. Today is the 21st of November 2008. I'm with Charles Sukila, who is the public sector advisor for the DFID office in Tanzania. We are in Umoja House in Dar es Salaam. And before we begin the interview, I'd like to ask if you've given your consent for this interview.
That's okay, we can proceed.
Thank you. So I'd like to begin the interview by asking you to again describe the responsibilities of your current position at DFID.
Yes, I'm a public sector advisor. My major role is to link up DFID initiatives with the government of Tanzania in as far as the core reforms are concerned, public sector reform program and other reform programs like legal sector reform programs and local government reform programs, but mainly public sector reform program.
Right, could you talk a little bit about your involvement in the public sector reform program?
Yes, as you may wish to know, DFID is one of the donor partners, development partners in financing and supporting the public sector reform program. So I come in to oversee what the government is doing and to advise them accordingly on interventions and decisions that would bring value for the involvement and value for resources as far as the program is concerned. It's a wide portfolio, maybe in the course of going, come up clearly into some specific interventions.
Certainly. If I'd just like to start, before we start talking about specific interventions, talk about the goals and the motivation for the reforms. What are the major challenges facing the civil service that the public sector, the public service reform program seeks to address?
For Tanzania specifically, the current round of reforms we have is a second phase. We had a first phase which ran from 2000 up till 2007, and then we are embarking on a second phase now, and then the third phase will follow later. The major challenges actually currently are those that were noted in the completion of the first phase, which were issues around harmonization and coordination of the major reform with other reforms. And then there were issues around capacity in terms of the government departments. And then there were also issues around linkages between the reform in the president's office, public service reform. The reform is coordinated from the president's office. That's the main government department which is supposed by coordinating reforms, but it is overseeing or it is running the reforms across other departments in the country. So there was a sort of a de-link between the president's office and the other MDAs, ministries, departments, and agencies. So that was also one of the challenges. The other one was on the execution ability, the speed of the reforms. It was a sort of the targets could not be met timely, and the aspirations could not be met wholesomely. So it's like maybe the ambitions were quite high, or there was not enough capacity to deliver all the aspirations of the reform program. Yeah.
Right. When you were talking about the problem with the delinking of the reforms from PSM, what sort of issues were those creating?
What happens is reform had major components, many components. The first phase, for example, had setting up institutions and building a culture of performance within the government and many other small and detailed components. Now, the public service reform department was mainly on top. They were supposed to just be coordinating and driving, but it was the MDAs, the other departments of the government who were actually supposed to undertake, to deliver, to do the actual work. But then they were not as much involved. I mean, the levels of consultation were not as as that much keen. It was like the whole work was being done by the PPSN. So their responsibilities changed from that of coordinating to more of an implementing agent. So that was one of the challenges that was really noted in the first round of the reform. But the second round now is addressing that.
So how is the second round addressing that?
Within the activity schedule, so there's what we call MTFA, medium-term expenditure framework, and then there's medium-term plans. So then the plans and the expenditure frameworks, there are a menu of activities that others are being done by the central coordinating ministry, and others are done by the other departments of the government. So it's a sort of a client service, client sort of the POPSM is a sort of a major client, but then other departments are sort of customers. So they agree on the areas, what are you going to do and what am I going to do and how are we going to do it. So there is a sort of a harmonized partnership. Yeah, and that's quite clear. So the POPSM, the President's Office Public Service Management, knows exactly what they are doing and how they are interlinking with other specific ministries and what any other ministry is doing. So that one is quite clear in the document, and the milestones, the objectives are set alongside that.
Okay. And at this point, how is that working out? How are those milestones and that planning working out?
What they've done, you see, we come in as development partners to advise and just keep an oversight, but the whole work is done by the government. So like in this particular case, what they did, the ministry, the coordinating ministry, which is President's Office Public Service Management, they came up with a work plan, and then they shared the work plan with the departments. And then they went down to the departments and they facilitated them to come up with the criteria of the issues they thought were priority as far as they are concerned. So after collecting those criteria and those priorities, then they came back and listed, compiled them and came up with an agreement that, okay, these are the priorities as far as Ministry of Education is concerned, Ministry of Health is concerned, Ministry of Agriculture, and this is what we'll be doing, and this is what they'll be doing. So such a harmonized arrangement.
And what has DFID's role been in this?
DFID is the major funder of the reform program. The current phase has about 100 million, US dollars, and DFID is putting in 40 million US dollars. So you see, that's quite considerable. The World Bank is putting in another 40 million, but that's a loan. The DFID intervention is a grant, and then the remaining 20 million is shared between the Canadians, the government itself, and other development partners. So you can see it's really a huge role. Yeah, and we also give in technical oversight and advisory roles depending on what the government require from us from time to time.
What sort of advice have you been giving? When has the government come to you?
Most of the issues would revolve around issues of best practices and experiences from other countries. As you know, DFID is involved with many other countries in Africa and in the world. So out of those cases, there are some experiences that might be useful to Tanzania. Then we feedback about those cases. We give them forums to share experiences. And then we also respond to specific requests that they may be asking or requiring. And we occasionally keep track on what they are doing when it comes like issues around procurement or issues around technical assistance. Sometimes we support and we recruiting and posting technical assistants who works with the President's Office, the Public Service Management, to try to help out with some outstanding issues and sometimes some systems and structures which are required to make things move. So there's a lot of involvement, technical involvement into this.
I wonder if we could talk a bit about merit recruitment and promotions. Have you had any experience with Tanzania's efforts to introduce merit systems?
Yeah, the first round of the reforms had a clear intervention in instituting meritocracy. You see, Tanzania is recovering from a huge socialistic hegemony. So the earlier public service that was built as early as 1961 onwards was more of socialized public service with a lot of civil servants, most of them underperforming and ill-trained, ill-equipped, and the promotion mechanisms were more of automatic. If you stay in job for a long time, automatically you move to the next phase and all these other things. And later, such systems would provide for some abuses, and some, political interferences and many other things. So the reforms came in late 90s. One of the areas that was highlighted to be turned around was issues around meritocracy and promotional phenomena. So that was really dealt with in the first phase of the reform, where the systems were set in place. So currently what happens is that normally when positions falls vacant, they'll be advertised, and then people will be encouraged to apply meritocratically and get recruited accordingly. You could get most of this information from the Department of Human Resource Development within the public service. And there is also a public service commission which is doing periodic audit to see to it that the compliances and requirements of the public service recruitment has been adhered to. And this aspect of meritocracy is also captured well in the Public Service Act, a new Act, 2002. Yeah.
Right. Are these criteria being used in practice? Are they adhering well to the new systems?
You could get some updated and some clean statistics around that from the Public Service Commission. But in our last review, they made us know that there is up to about 76% levels of compliance, which is quite satisfactory. While they are not 100% compliant, but at least 76%, you see, they are moving towards that.
And
we can follow that.
What do you think accounts for the gap, the 24%?
I won't be in position to speak about that, but I think it's all about doing with the systems and structures. But you also get to know that the challenges of the meritocracy is that sometimes there are cases where maybe there's no adequate capacity, the cases where the government feels like some of the posts still need to be held and be placed through the conventional appointment. So such cases, which especially in some key departments around forces and other departments, that they don't really bring them clearly for meritocracy purposes.
I understand that the civil service has implemented a performance management system. How has this worked out,
civil
in your
system?
Opinion? Performance management.
Performance management. Yeah, the first phase of the reforms was actually focused into instituting performance management. The second phase now is rolling out the performance management and instituting quality circle management. In the first phase, issues around the performance management, open appraisal systems were put in place, strategic plans and the whole package of the whole performance management system was installed, and it is in use, and there's a lot of compliance. I think Tanzania is one of the countries that is quite upfront and quite on top in the region as far as performance management is concerned.
So what is phase two attempting to do with regards to performance management?
Checking more on maintaining the trust and actually maintaining quality. That's why we talk about improving quality and quality cycles. Yeah. So building on what was built in phase one, building on the existing systems, existing structures, existing rules and regulations, and seeing to it that the quality is attained and is maintained. That is the major thrust. So we are talking more of about issues around having capacities, having adequate capacities in the MDAs to plan and deliver the plans accordingly, report back, of course, after monitoring and evaluation of what they've done. So it's all around quality improvement as far as the performance management is concerned.
And do you think the civil service provides an atmosphere and environment which civil servants can do their jobs effectively?
The service providers?
Do you think the civil service provides an atmosphere and environment in which civil servants can do their jobs effectively?
Maybe I'm not getting you clearly, but I hope you're trying to make a sense between the service providers and the working environment.
I'm asking whether there's a conducive working environment in the civil service.
Well, it depends on where we benchmark it from. There's a lot of improvement actually since reforms came in. But again, the private sector is still more competitive. And one of the issues that we are struggling with is actually whether to benchmark the service with using the private sector or using other public services elsewhere. Yeah, but when it comes to issues around pay and pay reform, the government is slightly lagging behind, although quite frequently there's been, you know, initiatives for the government to improve the pay and do pay reform, and then quite a lot of interventions in improving state-of-art capacity and putting facilities in place, putting systems and structures. Yeah, there's a lot of improvement since reform started, but it's not yet there. There's still some way to go.
And I'll get back to pay reforms later. What were the major obstacles encountered in implementing the performance management schemes?
Yeah, performance management schemes, you see elsewhere, as a rule of thumb, is that most staff would not be very open to it. Yeah, because it brings in, it's about change, and you know, many people are resistant to change. So Tanzania, like elsewhere in the world, there were some, you know, levels of compliance and, you know, embracing the change were quite a challenge. Normally, when we talk about performance management, the political will would be there, and there would be a big push from up. But the cascading of that downwards becomes a problem. When you talk about a huge public service like in Tanzania, where we have about 350,000 staff, you'd imagine cascading from higher levels all the way along to the lower levels becomes really a challenge, rolling it over. So that was one of the challenges. But again, the second challenge is that performance management systems works better when they're tied to incentives. Now, how do we incentivize? How do we provide incentives for such a big workforce? And is it something that can be done at a go, or is it something that can be done in phases? Like in earlier phase, the PMS were tied to what was called SASE, that's salary, self-accelerated salary enhancement scheme. But again, this one had to be, you know, somehow it had to be stopped because there was a feeling that maybe it's offering double standard for the same public service. But again, for such a big public service, where do you start from? So you see issues around the numbers, issues around funding the public service comes on board. How do we reward the performers to keep the performance going?
I've heard from one or two people concerns about the influence the president has in hiring and firing members of the civil service.
Mm.
Has this been problematic?
Mm.
And has it undermined the meritocratic ethos that has been introduced in the last reforms?
I wouldn't really think it's a problem in Tanzania, because for one, there is a very vibrant public service commission which is dedicated for dealing with issues around complaints and compliances around hiring and firing. I understand there are some cases around hiring and firing, but I don't think it's really an issue. It has not really come in as one of the challenges. I don't know what the government would be having in my as a feeling, but it has not come to the attention of the DPs as a challenge.
Sure. Could I ask you some questions about the Public Service Commission?
Mm.
Could you describe the Public Service Commission's structure and its responsibilities?
Oh, wow. This one, I wish you had an appointment with them, but currently they are undergoing through some structural changes. And what we know as DPs is that they are moving from the implementers to a sort of a compliant institution. Yeah, initially, a few years back, they used to recruit, but now they are no longer recruiting, so they are just there to check on whether the compliance has been met as far as recruitment is concerned. And they were also highly concerned with issues around teachers' service. You know, teachers provide a huge bulk of the workforce. It's around 180,000 teachers in this country. That's about 54% of the total workforce. So they also used to do recruitment of those of the teachers and take care of that. And it was actually a commission, a teacher service commission. But now with the new structure, the teacher service commission has been collapsed. So it is a department within the public service commission. And it's also moving towards being a compliant, you know, a compliance audit institution. They have they're still going through some institutional changes. I'm not really clear with the ultimate final structure. Yeah, I wish you would talk to them. Madam Shangali, the executive secretary, is quite useful. She's very informative.
So the next area I'd like to touch on is pay policy.
Mm.
Can you talk about the major changes that have been made in the civil service with regards to pay policy?
Maybe not changes as such, but issues and tracking them down from where they've come from and how they are going. The national pay policy is more towards what we call compression and decompression of the pay ratios. And development partners has been quite keen on that, really negotiating with the government to put the compressions and decompression ratios right. That's one of the key elements. And then there's issues around the general improving the emolument of the civil servants, which also has been trailing. And there's also issues around allowances, per diems. Then allowances and per diems that are offered to civil servants when they go for some specific assignments. So that also has been an element of the pay policy, and it has been captured. They're trying to really reduce the allowances so that interventions should be done through the mainstream time schedule, and the staff should be, the public servants should treat whatever they are doing as part of their day-to-day work and not as part of not project-oriented approach. And then there's issues around equity, definitely, and across the cadres and across geographical dynamics. Tanzania is a very big country. One of the challenges currently is how to get civil servants attracted and stay in the underserved areas, in the peripheries, and the pay policy is also trying to address that. So there's quite some nice elements around that.
So how is the pay policy trying to attract civil servants to underserved areas?
There's two major initiatives going about that. One, there was a presidential commission that was formed last year. They've given in their report sometimes back. It's still not yet released for the public, which was trying to see how to implement the pay policy and how to put up systems and mechanisms to attract staff in the underserved areas. But there's also the President's Office Public Service Management is also working on a document, a sort of a strategy, which would see to it that there is some attractions and some emoluments for staff who are based in the underserved areas. We still don't know the contents of the paper yet because it has to go through the government and the cabinet secretariat, but in the last review just a couple of weeks ago, they made us know that they are working on a comprehensive document, and the good news is that it is not financial based. I mean, it's a non-financial incentive mechanism. So they're trying to come up with some other areas and that could, some other, you know, benefits that could attract staff apart from the conventional financing, which we think is really, it's likely to add some value.
Do you have any idea what those could be?
Not the details of the same, but tentatively, like they've divided the country into several geographical zones so that they don't have a holistic holistic offer to the whole country because situations are quite different. But two is that they've also came up with quite a lot of other criteria around issues around access to further training and issues around how those who stay in the underserved areas get the basic services, like do they get their salaries on time, and what about housing and other state-of-art facilities, which could really issues around education to their children and some other, you know, those comprehensive emolument issues that might attract them in the underserved areas.
Could you talk about the issues of allowances? How has the government changed its policy with regard to allowances?
As development partners, we are yet to see a comprehensive change towards this, but time and again the government is pledging change and support into doing what the development partners are advising, that allowances still remains to be a high element of the expenditure of the government. So something still debate about it's going to feature. We'll be having a general budget support review next week. This is one of the issues that will be critically discussed.
Okay. You also talked about the compression ratios in pay policy and decompression.
Yes.
What attempts have been made to decompress pay?
Every time when the government is doing pay adjustments, they really try to address the issue of the compression and decompression ratios. And we normally request that to get to see the ratios and have an idea of how the progress is made. In the last review, one of our concerns was that maybe they need to break it further into professional categories. Because if it's just offered wholesomely, then it does not give us much understanding, because it would be the same. We will be talking about the compression ratios from the uppermost civil servant to the least civil servant, maybe from a cleaner to from a secretary to the permanent secretary. So such ratios cannot make much sense. But if we are talking about some job categories, then at least we can have an idea that, well, here there's still a gap here and there's still not a gap here. So we are waiting for some of the updated ratios as far as this comment is concerned.
And what have been the challenges in getting these ratios correct?
I don't think it's a matter of challenge. I think it's just a matter of working. I mean, working out the ratios. Yeah, if they're worked out and they are broken down according to categories, that makes sense, I think. It's something that can be done because the statistics are there and the data is there. I don't think it's something that really amounts to any challenge.
What information have you been using to measure the effects of the pay changes?
The effect
of the pay changes.
Well, when we get to know the wage bill, one of the quick indicators is getting how it relates to the GDP, wage bill as percentage of the GDP, and the wage bill GDP ratio could quickly tell you whether the government is faring well or is not faring well. There might be some other economic indicators, but GDP to the ratios actually makes a lot of quick sense.
And has there been, apart from the SASE, have there been other efforts to use pay policy to increase the attractiveness of the civil service?
Definitely, yes. Yeah, that is the underpinning principle of the pay policy, so that it would be able to see more qualified and more senior civil servants keeping around and staying around in the job. Actually, currently, we do demand that we see the numbers and the ratios of the departures, the turnover ratios, those who are moving out of the civil service, especially at master's and PhD levels. And we are seeing the trend going down, which is suggesting that somewhere, somehow, there is some attraction. But again, it boils down into the compression and decompression ratio. So the two goes together.
So what do you think the main reasons for the reduction in turnover has been?
Slightly because of the improved pay in the government, improved work conditions, and some other improvement in terms of state-of-art capacity and other issues around emolument, which are not necessarily financial, like job security, opportunities for further study, and such similar trends which can be attracting civil servants to hang on and stay on.
How has the population, the general public, reacted to the changes in pay for civil servants?
Wow, I wish we had a study on that. Yeah, that could be a potential area for maybe having a big study, but I would say that they've reacted positively or negatively, but at least I know that the government is normally setting up a pace and then the private sector follow. So if the government pushes the equilibrium up, then the private sector will have to keep the equilibriums higher so that they would be able to retain the workforce they have and get more of the workforce. But the general public, maybe, I wouldn't really say what the reaction is, but when government does adjustment in terms of pay, just so that the private sector would follow and later the civil society would also follow. So you see, it's like the government is the determinant. So when we push for, when we negotiate for better pay in terms of in the civil service, then chances are that this would cascade throughout the entire country.
Okay. And have there been any pressures with regards to the total wage bill? How have those been balanced with the needs to increase pay?
That's a complicated question. You see, when you increase pay, you are eventually swelling the wage bill. Yeah. Now, in a country like Tanzania, where the current establishment has not been attained, with the 350,000 civil servants, we are not yet even up to 90% of the total establishment. So by the time there is a whole establishment, maybe the civil servant service would be about 500,000. And now you can imagine how that one itself is exerting a lot of pressure on the pay. Like now, we have the government has the initiatives on the Vision 2025, which is well captured in the National Growth and Poverty Reduction Strategy, which is aspiring that services would need to be devolved down to the communities. So we are talking about having all key expertise at the district level. So sending people at the districts in a country with more than 140-something districts, so it means that at the end of the day, there's a huge establishment. So this would implicate back on the payroll in terms of numbers, and then in terms of figures, and other dynamics around that.
So how does the government plan on, how do you think the government plans on managing those issues? The increasing wage bill because of the increasing staff numbers and also the need to increase pay?
Yeah, there is two levels. One is the annual increase, which is inevitable because population is increasing, and then the services must also increase to people, so there must be growth in civil service. But there's other aspect of the devolution, the decentralization, devolution, taking more services to more people, increasing service delivery, which pushes for even more numbers, more people. So those are captured in the national pay policy, but even the wider national, we call it Mkukuta here, in a Swahili acronym for the National Growth and Poverty Reduction Strategy. So the milestones and the medium-term expenditure frameworks and medium-term strategies captures these projections. Yeah. So it's like as the civil service expands, as the wage bill swells, then it is captured in the plans, ahead of the plans. Our major concern is that if the economy does not grow to match up the expansion, then we'll be having unfavorable figures in the GDP, in the ratios of the GDP of the wage bill to GDP, and then that might not be very healthy. Yeah.
So the next area I'd like to talk to you about is managing the reforms and the approach the government has taken in the reforms. Could you describe the role DFID had in planning the reform process?
I won't really talk about that, because I wish you had a discussion with my colleague Ian, who was around when the reforms were being chatted out. But DFID has been a trusted partner from the first round of the reforms, actually, as early as 1995, 96. And quite a lot has happened, especially in supporting, bringing in technical assistance, financing consultancies. Quite a lot has gone on there. Yeah.
Okay. What have been the major challenges facing the government in implementing the reforms?
As government, I think most of the challenges could be the earlier challenges that we addressed earlier about general challenges that are there as far as implementation of the reforms is concerned. Issues around capacity, issues around financing, harmonization of the reforms. Like currently there's a lot of reforms. We have about 5 core reforms, and then we have several sectoral reforms. So you see, when they all come, it's like there is an impetus to move. So if you don't control this movement, then you may be having reforms that are not talking to one another. You may be having some specific sectoral report reforms moving this way, and the centralized understanding also moving on the other way. So those areas has been really a challenge, although there's a lot of forums for discussion and talking, especially from the DP side. But from the government side, time and again we tend to observe that even within the same ministry, there are some departments that are not talking to one another. They all have good aspirations of pushing, moving ahead, but then they are not consulting enough. So you find that they are systems that are contradicting, and there's also some duplications. Yeah.
So where where are there duplications or contradicting systems?
For one, when systems are acquired that are put in place, like we have just noted in the recent review that most departments, most MDAs were involved into installing HMSs, human resource management information system, and some other management information systems within their specific departments for sectoral management. And the POPSM, the President's Office, was also in the process of installing some MIS systems. And these systems were not talking to one another. So at the end of the day, it's a duplication of effort, and sometimes we'll be having the same set of information here and there, and sometimes the informations are not harmonized, they are contradicting, and such issues. And we also have areas where we have contradicting policies, although that one has been really worked on. But that is still one of the areas that need to be attended to.
Okay. And what has worked well so far in the way the reforms have been managed? Where do you think Tanzania has been very successful in managing its reforms?
I think maintaining the reform, this is about 8th year, and some of the good practices that were attained earlier on are still, they've been able to stay on, they've been tested. Like we have executive agencies that has been doing exceptionally well since establishment. Most of them are now fully fledged, quite independent. Yeah. So there's some other elements that are really moving on very well.
Okay, before we finish, I wonder if I could ask you about, if you had a chance to manage, to write a handbook or a manual for people who have to manage civil service reform, what kinds of topics would you consider most important to know about?
One is coordination of the reforms. Coordination of the reforms in the light of other reforms, if any. Two is political awareness. Yeah, the managers of the reform need to be really, to be in context on, are they right with the politics? Do they play their politics well? Do they pull enough clout? Do they command respect to the politicians, maybe to the president, to the prime minister? So those two, three areas, I think, are the really core. The technical side of the management may really come in, depending on the specific reform. But the coordination aspect, the political awareness aspect, I think those are really core as far as...
How has the political awareness aspect played out in Tanzania?
It depends, but at the end of the day, we must agree that the take of the politicians, the president, the ministers, can really implicate reforms. If they are pro a reform program, then chances are that program will really move ahead. But if they are skeptical, they are not keen into the reforms, there is not enough political push, then chances are that the reforms might not really move ahead. Yeah.
And has there been support in Tanzania?
Not really. It's good that at least since reforms came in, the past president has been, Mkapa was quite positive with the reforms and actually was the major force pushing in reforms. And even Kikwete is quite pro-reforms. But we also have some other reforms like legal sector reform program, which is not really moving as much as we may wish to see it moving. We couldn't blame it for the minister or for the politicians, but maybe if there was more and more political will, there might have been some more leap as far as the reform is concerned.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there anything else you would like to add as we finish up?
Just two quick things. One is that I would be very happy if you serve us with a copy of your findings, because this is quite an interesting area. And you see even development partners are also, at a time we are also caught in a maze on seeing balancing between how to advise in reforms and manage reforms and how to not to. Because we do not want to micromanage in the government, especially in the setup where we work through basket funds and through general budget support. But again, if it is totally hands off, eyes off, then things don't move. So what you've just asked, your last question, that what would one think to be areas of concern as far as managing reforms is concerned, I think the same also goes to what would development partners like to get to know as far as managing reforms is concerned. It's both ways.
Thank you very much.
Good.